Scarlett Johansson, slut. Government inadequacy and true love. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions, number 4. So, fair warning, I'm having one of those days of just one unexpected event after another and technical difficulties and nothing serious, just very, very difficult to get through. So, I've decided now, after a number of takes, I'm just gonna go from start to finish. So, if you hear dogs, if you hear children screaming, if you hear the house collapsing around me, episode 4 will go on. But you might have heard during the intro my reference to Scarlett Johansson, the actress, in not too friendly terms. She's one of the superheroes in the Avengers. It's one of her major accomplishments recently. And to me, she's always one of the people in the hagiographic pre-Obama presidency, pro-Obama videos where all the stars got together and sang and recited from his speeches, "Yes, we can." And she was one of those, very, very, very intent on having President Obama be a reality. So anyway, she was doing an interview with Playboy magazine, which, if you've heard, is now bringing back the nudity, which seems to be, you know, the joke used to go, I'm reading it for the articles, and apparently that was never true. But people are reading it for Scarlett Johansson's interview. And one of the things that caught my attention in this, she's talking about life and motherhood and her recent separation at the young age of 32 from her second husband. And what she said, this is the quote, "I think the idea of marriage is very romantic. It's a beautiful idea. And the practice of it can be a very beautiful thing. I don't think it's natural to be a monogamous person." Which I respond to by, no, duh. I mean, we're human beings, right? We're meant to transcend our nature. That's kind of the point of it all. That's why we have these institutions, and that's what they're supposed to draw us to, being better people. Of course, that doesn't appear to be the point of it all for the starlet. She goes on to describe how profound it was to become a mother. And here's the quote for that. "I understand the importance of my own happiness now more than I did before." So she had a child, brought another human being into life, and it's completely dependent upon her, and she'll help mold this child and determine its future. And the important thing there is her own happiness. I mean, that really says it all. I mean, that's a source of meaning for too many people these days, I would say. But it made me think of reading that made me think of something that Andrew Klavan, he's a commentator, a Hollywood guy actually, who turned Christian and conservative and generally humorous, but also conservative, which the two do go together sometimes. And he has a podcast that I listen to, and he was talking about for Valentine's Day, he was talking about sort of comparing versions of love in pop culture and how we see them. And so he looked at the more modern, although not so much anymore if you're under, say, 30, but the more modern movie, The English Patient. And it's mainly famous for putting boyfriends to sleep, I think. But in that movie, love is, Klavan says, love is materialistic. It's self-centered. Nothing matters in the world except the love of our main characters. They're in the middle of a war, and that doesn't matter. What matters is them and their love. Now, in a more traditional view, Klavan puts forward Casablanca, and it's different. It's there, the famous line, Humphrey Bogart, "The problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world." So that's a very different... Their love, they truly do love each other, but the love is only expressed by understanding that you're part of something bigger. And that's kind of Klavan's perspective here. And so here's a clip of his explanation.
The point is, to be worthy of love, to be capable of love, you have to put something above yourself. So the question is, are you what the movies show you you are, a body having sex, a slave basically to your pleasures and to physical sensations and to your impulses? Or are you a spirit who loves something higher, who can then reach the kind of love that is actual real love, the kind of love you saw in Casablanca?
So love, contrary to the modern view, is not selfish. It's giving. The Catholic phrasing is that it's desiring the good of the other. And actually, it brings to mind this weekend's reading at Catholic masses, and sort of how in this era of social media and everything's about me and getting my view out there, how that's got everything backwards. And the reading was from the Gospel, and it's very famous. So even if you're not Christian, you might have heard this one. It's Jesus. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, offer no resistance to one who is evil. When someone strikes you on your right cheek, turn the other one as well. If anyone wants to go to law with you over your tunic, hand over your cloak as well. Should anyone press you into service for 1 mile, go for 2 miles. Give to the one who asks of you, and do not turn your back on the one who wants to borrow. And so this often is taken as a very pacifistic passage, and on its surface it is. But I say, and the priest who read the homily and gave his homily afterwards said that it doesn't mean there aren't boundaries. It's really about your frame of mind and interacting with other people. And I'd say the point I'd add to that is that we set the boundaries from our perspective. So when you set boundaries, it's not for you. That's the important thing. You're setting boundaries for the benefit of other people who might be hurt by this person, or especially for that person's own good. If they're behaving in a way that's bad, that's bad for them. And if you truly love them as your neighbor and you want them to come to their full fruition as a person, you want to correct them. And a lot of boundaries are about a lot about that. It's funny, today I won't go into details, so as not to get anybody in trouble, but I had a situation where I thought a contractor I was buying some stuff from was trying to be a little bit sneaky about the materials I was getting. And honestly, if the materials had been sold to me as I requested, or as the person wanted to sell them to me, then it would have been fine. But there was this kind of deception about that I was getting one thing and I actually was probably getting another. Point being, you almost feel obligated to, even though I'm fine with it, I'm going to use the materials as they are, you almost feel obligated to go and, you know, hey, I know what you did, just so the guy knows, and there's some kind of catch and some kind of consequence, at least in that person's own mind. But again, so social boundaries are for other people, and this is a secular podcast, but I may be going a little heavy on the religious stuff, but similar is Augustine's letter, 157, and by the way, I know some scholars think it's Augustine. Well, yeah, I like Augustine. So, but anyway, letter 157, he says, we must never say that it is no use for them to live chastely in the married state. These are people who aren't Christian. To direct their houses and families in a Christian way, or to heap up for themselves heavenly treasures by their acts of mercy. What he's saying is, if you tell them, you know what, you're not Christian, so it's not good enough for you, you're not good enough for it, or you don't bother with it, that's judging them, Augustine says, in arrogant haughtiness. So again, loving others means willing them to good ends, not celebrating their particular conditions or saying, I don't care what you do. It's saying, I do care what you do, and I want you to do well. I posted today or yesterday on Ocean State Current about a great essay, and I highly recommend it. The link, if you follow the link to this podcast, it's under the recording, by Nicholas Eberstadt, who's he's a economist and demographer for the American Enterprise Institute. And in recent years, his emphasis has been heavily on young men their plight of men in working in a working range, 25 to 54, or whatever it might be, and how they're starting to drift from a healthy form of behavior. And this article talks about how since the turn of the century and certainly since the Great Recession, we've seen this workforce decline, which isn't explicable by people retiring or having no children or whatever. There's actually decreases in the number of people who are working, who could and should be working. And men and women, all races, but especially, except I think black women it doesn't apply to, but everybody else it applies to, but especially white men. And Eberstadt goes into some good detail about how they're finding ways to live without working through welfare programs and disability, and they're using Medicaid to get Oxycontin, and so essentially they're sitting around high watching TV instead of working, and that's just not, whatever it is for the economy, that's not a good political, it's not a good outcome for people. We shouldn't want people to go to that, and if our policies are drawing people to that, they're bad policies. So we should want to fix that and get them working. I mean, it may generate votes. I mean, people who are scared of actually used to doing something and nothing, that they get scared of doing something, and also they're high on drugs. Those people are going to be, if you can get them off the couch, more likely to vote for the person who says, you know what, I'll keep your drugs coming. So there's this government dependency that has a sort of a whole new meaning. And the other angle for public policy relates to another essay, this one on National Review Online, by Ramesh Panuru. And he's participating in some kind of project to talk about paid family leave, which is a big promise in Rhode Island that they like to tell people they can have paid family leave and it's free and don't worry, it's great and it's a human right and all that. But what Panuru draws out is some of his other interlocutors on this panel are talking about how these policies have to include fathers as well as mothers. And Panuru says that policy may be good or bad, but it's the rationale that's the problem. So the other people, and I'm sorry I didn't write down their names, the link again is on the post of this podcast, but they say that, quote, while the gender revolution has been largely successful at promoting women's roles in the workplace, there has been less progress in nudging men toward traditionally female roles like childcare. And Pernero's point is that this is not expanding parents' choices. This is pushing them toward the choices that the progressives approve of. And that's, Panuru asks, is that really government's business? I'd almost go farther and say this is tyranny. This is using government to bend people to your will. Now, your will may be good or bad, but it's your will, not theirs, and you're forcing them into it. And it gets to this concept I've been following and writing about on the Ocean State Current for years, of nudging. That word, it's insidious. It gets everywhere. It sounds so, okay, I'm just nudging you. It's nothing big. It's like this passive aggressive version of forcing, right? I'm nudging you. But some years ago, I highlighted some of these concepts of nudging. And what they mean is setting up government policy in a way that makes government-preferred behaviors more attractive or other behaviors not attractive. So you're free to do what they tell you to do, right? That's sort of the way freedom works now. And what was disconcerting in 2013, actually, was it started to be not even limited to progressives. I mean, there were conservatives talking about the buzzwords, like harnessing behavioral science. I mean, that's manipulating. I've compared that to torture. What's the difference? It's just a nicer way of manipulating people. And it's chilling just thinking of this phrase, this other phrase. They say policymakers, that's politicians basically, can become choice architects. I mean, that's just chillingly cold. Like we're buildings, and they're forcing us into these prison-like buildings, and they're gonna it's actually a maze that only has one direction you can go, right? It's that your choice architecture. You always end up where, actually, whichever way you go, you always end up where the central planners want you to. And just the other day, actually, speaking of conservatives on this nudging kick, there's the author Tim Scott, who wrote on National Review Online, and he's encouraging, I guess it's a new policy, I think, in Congress, the Investing in Opportunity Act, which would give corporations an opportunity to give money to charities and not pay it in taxes. But, you know, the government gets to pick what's eligible for this giveaway, what counts as a good deed. The businesses aren't really choosing to do good. They're choosing to get a tax break, and they'd just rather give the money to a charity than straight to government for whatever reason, probably because they've got an interest in it. But, if you've ever read Anthony Burgess's excellent book, Clockwork Orange, the movie's good, but the book is much better and the message is much, much healthier. But if you've ever read that, the central point is Alex, the thug, doesn't stop being a thug because he wants to. It doesn't fix him. It just makes him physically ill to think of doing bad things, and he has no free. You've taken his free will away. You're making him an animal, in much the same way as emphasizing the impossibility of monogamy and saying, "Hey, well then go, forget it then. Just go ahead, do what you want." I mean, you're making people into animals, and we don't need coercive government. We need to let people figure out what is good and encourage them by other means. It's only a little bit of a sharp break here to the next point I wanted to make, which was the Governor Gina Raimondo, the other day in her press conference on the Unified Health Infrastructure Project, UHIP, also known as Rhode Island Bridges, if it ever gets working, essentially admitted that government sucks. I mean, she put it much better than I just did, so let me just play her clip for you.
The unfortunate thing here is this isn't unique. This is, unfortunately, how government IT rollouts tend to go. Vermont, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Kentucky, California.
Oh, well, okay then. This is just how government goes. It can't do anything right. So don't worry about it when it doesn't do anything right. So here's an important detail I think ought to be kept into the discussion.
And one thing that is crystal clear, which I've learned in the last month, is that we didn't have enough high-quality IT state staff to hold Deloitte accountable. So we were overly reliant on them. And when they came to us and said, "Look at this dashboard, it's all green," our CTO said, you know, he questioned it, but they had a lot of people. We didn't have enough tech staff on our side or enough experienced technologists on our side to hold them accountable, which, as I've personally been spending a lot of time talking to other states, talking to the people who did the turnaround of healthcare.gov, and that's a very common thing in the public sector.
I love that. It's like something out of Monty Python or something, or National Lampoon. Oh, look at all these, look at the dashboard. It's green. It's, you know, oh, this machine's wonderful. It goes ping. And this is the one that goes ping, goom, ping, goom. The dashboard's green, which means good. We're looking on paper. We're the central planners. We're the experts. And the paper's green. So, hey, what could be wrong there? But notice that, as always, the solution is more money, more staff, more stuff and authority and power for government, when the problem is actually incentives. We keep giving government these tasks politicians aren't competent to accomplish, and that's not necessarily anything bad. It's just outside of their sphere of knowledge or ability, and the incentives are all wrong. The bigger problem is they don't actually know what they don't know. So they can't beforehand know whether they've got the right number of technologists, as Raimondo kept calling them. And again, their incentive is to tell people, in the terms of this podcast, that they love them, right? That's sort of their role. We love you. We're going to give you stuff. We're going to make you better, and your life better. And again, it's about incentives, which actually is something that the governor seems to understand as she goes on. Here it is.
Do you feel like Deloitte purposely misled you or lied to you?
No, I just think that they presented me with a rosier picture than they were. I mean, I think the incentive for a vendor is to want to please the client. I really think that's what this was. Everyone just wanted to deliver.
So the politicians want to please the voter by proclaiming their love and giving them stuff and buying their votes. And the vendor wants to please the client in the now and say, oh, we're doing just fine. That's the incentive. And so there's no real accountability because the goal isn't, in a sense, the deeper love of accomplishing something, of actualization and improving society, but the immediate love of proving affection, of proving we've done this for you and therefore deserve our paycheck. And that's really when we're, you know, small government people who say we still want to accomplish good things. We still want charity and we still think people ought to help each other. But we have to pick our institutions wisely and we have to construct them wisely. Institutions have to address human nature. We have, for example, marriage and such institutions to control the human inclination toward behavior that isn't healthy. We've got marriage to give, to be able to pull parents together to raise their children, even though their natural lusts might pull them to seek other partners. And it also helps them, forces them to deal with their responsibilities and makes them better people in that way, gets them off the couch and out working. And it's not healthy to have in a civilized, advanced society to ignore these incentives. And another point I've always made about marriage, particularly during same-sex marriage debate some time ago, was that marriage isn't a collection of benefits from the government. It's not a contract necessarily. It's a non-government institution that controls behavior with the greatest amount of individual freedom possible and the least amount of coercion. So we're saying, hey, if you're doing things that create children, then get together when we have this institution, and you technically you can get out of it. But we were investing social equity social equity into this institution, and we need to start using other institutions, churches, marriage, business, instead of government, because the incentives and a human nature make government a terrible way to accomplish social objectives. Not the least because it's subject to abuse and decisions, not just abuse of corruption sense, but decisions become imposed not because they're rational or because they're right or because they will bring the good of the other, of the recipient, but because the supporters of those decisions have power. I mean, the decision, in a sense, comes first, judged on whatever criterion, usually some kind of ideology or belief system, and it's made before a policy even comes into it. So you get something like bigotry and hate speech. These are empty terms that people fill with some kind of meaning and they define it as whatever they don't like. And nature becomes like that, whether it's for Scarlett Johansson or what have you. It becomes, you know, nature is just a way of assigning a progressive value, like bigotry and hate speech are a way of assigning progressive lack of value or distaste. This has really been coming across, and this is why you get, on the one hand, you've got nature, you know, Scarlett Johansson saying nature, hey, being monogamous isn't natural, so we ought to be not monogamous. On the other hand, you've got things where you're encouraging people to, as the phrase used to be, let their freak flag fly, because they're bringing out their real nature, which maybe they don't necessarily move toward naturally or is not actually part of their physical nature. So this is one of the ways this has come up recently that I've written about, is this idea that we've got legislation that's actually going to ban people from practicing, professionals from practicing conversion therapy, which is to help people try to just reduce their same-sex attractions. At the same time, we've got Medicaid paying for transgender operations. So the idea isn't consistent. There's no freedom, or, you know, you make your decision, you follow through, you're building on your nature. It's these empty terms, bigotry, hate speech, nature, all become just a way to enact the policy, political policies, for an ideological purpose. And that is the coherent running theme. Actually, it seems like it's not quite associated, but I've been coming across a lot of things recently for some reason that people have written about me that seem strange. I'm always looking for feedback, and whenever anybody criticizes me, I go back and I try honestly to figure out if they have a point, because often they do, and most often perhaps. So for example, the other day I came across somebody who was complaining on Facebook that I had used big words and I was trying to seem smart in a post I put up. And, you know, I went back because I know this has always been an issue since college, and reading all that Melville and Hawthorne, and I just came out of it using way too many big words, partly because they're accurate and they describe the concept I was trying to describe, but also because, I don't know, it just felt like the style, not necessarily to prove how great I was, but just it set the tone, the shape of the words, the sound. But I went back and I read this piece, and honestly, I couldn't see many words that were all that extravagant. Things I've said at public meetings, I saw there's a letter in the Fall River Herald actually right now that says I asked, criticizes me for asking the fire chief if he could take a used police car for his vehicle. And the person wrote this as if it's just obviously foolish thing to ask. To me, it's not. It's maybe he's driving a car that's 15, 16 years old, maybe a newer one will keep him going for what his purpose is. I don't know. I was just in the question I was asking. Similarly, a few years back, I was involved in a charter complaint in Tiverton, and the lawyer for the defendant asked about something I had done or seen, and I said I don't recall, and he said, oh, you don't recall or you don't remember? I said, whichever one. whether you remember or recall. And one of the people in town who hates me said, oh, well, he didn't even know the difference between recall and remember. And I have to be honest, I'm still not quite sure what the distinction was. But the point is that these people, I don't think, really know whether these are silly things. They just, or that I'm using big words or whatever. They've made the decision that I'm silly and that I'm wrong and that I'm egotistical or whatever. And that comes before the policy. And it really goes to show it can be difficult and this is something I try to work on and have trouble with, to react in a way that's not just reacting and insulting and getting in a fight with them, but in reacting in a way that wills the good of the other, that loves the person saying this about me, and trying to frame responses not only in the moment, but over time, and ways of interacting with them, so it can maybe not nudge them, but move them in the direction of being better people themselves. And that, you know, it's a big challenge, but I think it's worth doing. And I'm thinking more and more with the craziness around and the angst and anger about Donald Trump, President Donald Trump. We need to figure this out. We need to figure out how do we get people to interact in a way that it's clear that they want the best thing for the person who has something against them, and how do we get people to structure their own lives and public policy to give them the flexibility to structure their own lives in a way that's positive for them. And then we use other institutions to do the nudging, you know, interpersonal responses. We nudge by talking. We nudge through other institutions than government, because maybe that's the problem with Donald Trump and President Obama too. We made government so big and so all-encompassing in the name of nudging people that it's so important to own government, whereas if we spread it out and what was important was trying to work with each other, then government wouldn't be as big a deal. We would want to reduce its size so that we could interact in a way that makes the other person better off, makes them think better. So maybe that's our project. It's a big one. But so that's all I got to say this week. As always, there should be a link on this podcast. There are all the links to things I mentioned, and also places to leave comments and a way to contact me. And I'm always looking for responses. And other than that, have a great one.